forcibly removed from here has been filled in by other pro-Palestinian activists, among them Leicester locals, who say this site here is next.
The two closed sites included Elbit's London headquarters and a factory in Greater Manchester, the result of Palestine Action's sustained campaign of direct action in the past 2 years. But it hasn't been easy for them.
Back in May, we were arrested. Most of the Palestine Action people were arrested, and we were given bail conditions. They took our phones and they gave us bail conditions not to be by the site. So what it's meant is that all the people who were really committed routinely were not able to support holding the site.
Yet none of that has fazed these activists, who say every moment an Elbit site is forced to close is a triumph for the Palestinian cause. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Western countries turn their backs on the people of Afghanistan as the NGOs and charities are facing a severe funding gap. Jan Egeland, the head of NRC, in a recent statement has said the NATO countries are turning a blind eye to the plight of the starving Afghan children they left behind, only because the country is not strategically as important as it once used to be. According to some Afghan analysts, Western nations bear responsibility for the challenges endured by the Afghan population and should take corrective measures to address their mistakes.
The plights which Afghan people are facing today are caused mostly by NATO countries, especially the U.S., which invaded our country for 20 years. Today's devastation and crisis in our country are all the results of the U.S. ill policies and decisions. First, they fought a war here, then handed the country to the Taliban, and now they are putting our people under pressure with economic restrictions.
The UN says more than 28 million people in Afghanistan are in dire need of humanitarian aid, especially women and children. Many of them are on the brink of famine and malnutrition. Afghan people say they are awaiting foreign aid for their survival, as they have lost their incomes.
We are not receiving foreign aid anymore. I'm an ordinary worker. I come here every morning to get a job, but no one hires us and we go back home with nothing in our hands. I have a large family and we live in a rented house. I call on the global community not to forget our plights and help us with anything they can. This is the situation of everyone here.
Our sole complaint is that the Western countries created this situation and left us behind. They fueled the war, instability and poverty here and escaped at once. They claim to be sending relief aid, but their small donations are not enough, nor are they reaching qualified people.
This comes as the UK government has been criticized for slashing its aid to Afghanistan by more than half. The US has also frozen Afghan central bank assets and maintained sanctions, paralyzing the economy and other vital infrastructure. After 2 decades of the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, people here are struggling to meet their basic needs. They are calling for more humanitarian aid from wealthy countries and international organizations to mitigate the crisis in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The chairman of the National Assembly of Vietnam, Vuong Dinh Hu, arrived in Tehran heading a high-level parliamentary delegation at an invitation of his Iranian counterpart, Mohammad Baghir Ghalibaf. In a meeting, the visiting Vietnamese parliament speaker expressed hope that during this trip, the two countries would be able to expand and develop economic and commercial cooperation, as the countries enjoy a lot of capacity for economic cooperation and investment. Iran's parliament speaker, for his part, said Iran's priority in foreign policy is to pay special attention to East Asian states, including Vietnam, due to existing cultural commonalities. Right after the meeting, Iran and Vietnam signed a memorandum of understanding to expand parliamentary cooperation.
Parliamentary diplomacy between the two countries can prepare the ground for strengthening bilateral ties at both regional and international levels. Further efforts should be made to strengthen cultural, tourism, scientific and academic cooperation between the two countries and promote the exchange of citizens' visits by facilitating visa issuance, launching a direct flight between Tehran and Hanoi, and setting up a joint banking committee between the two countries can also facilitate the promotion of bilateral relations.
Vietnam attaches great importance to the significant role of Iran in the West Asian region. Our country pays attention to the policy of strengthening friendship and cooperation between Iran and Vietnam in various parliamentary and governmental areas. The problem of financial exchange between the two countries can be solved by establishing a banking committee between the two countries.
Both sides have frequently supported each other in international organizations, particularly at the United Nations, to uphold multilateralism, build a multipolar world order, and respect the sovereignty and legitimate interests of nations and people. According to official reports, the volume of trade between the two nations surpassed $120 million 2 years ago, but the number has the potential to reach $2 billion in the future.
Observers believe that the visit to Tehran by Speaker of the Vietnamese Parliament after 24 years is seen as a turning point in bilateral ties, especially as it coincides with the 50th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between Iran and Vietnam. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
A panel discussion dubbed systematic hate speech in violation of the right of freedom of expression by the Swedish government, with a special focus on the recent Quran desecration incidents, discussed what they referred to as government-sponsored acts of blasphemy. The participants included representatives of different monotheistic faiths as well as scholars and researchers who unanimously denounced the acts of desecration in Sweden as a violation of human rights and the right to freedom of thought, belief and religion.
The Quran burning incident in Sweden is completely unacceptable. However, we should not forget that without a government support, this would not have happened. They claim to be supporting the right of freedom of expression, but let's not forget that freedom can never be absolute. There are always boundaries, and you are free to do what you want, only if it does not undermine other people's freedom.
This was not just a desecration of the Holy Book of Muslims. In the Holy Quran, the name of God has been repeated many times. The God that we too believe in, as well as the name of our prophet Moses. Burning smoke is simply barbaric. If you disagree with an ideology or a religious belief, you should state your thoughts and your logic and discuss with the scholars. Such acts show the person who did it and those who supported his actions are incapable of doing so.
I believe that a panel discussion just like the one we had today has to be held on an international level. It is essential for people worldwide to share their opinion because such acts of blasphemy are carried out because of ignorance. Also, we have to adhere to moral values no matter what we believe in. And any person in their right mind agrees that it is against all moral standards to insult other people and their beliefs.
That is why all the participants say the recent acts of blasphemy have brought the true colors of countries that claim to be advocates of human rights to light.
Back in July, and after the Quran burning incidents in Sweden, a deeply divided UN Human Rights Council passed a controversial resolution urging countries to address, prevent, and prosecute acts of religious hatred. The resolution was passed with 8 countries voting for, 12 countries voting against, and 7 abstaining. Interestingly enough, the U.S. and the EU strongly opposed this resolution, proving once again that concepts such as human rights and freedom of expression are merely political tools at the hands of these countries. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
From Hollywood to hotel workers to Teamsters to manufacturing and elsewhere, there are so many labor actions in the United States, the mainstream media is calling it a hot labor summer. The problem isn't record heat, but low wages, poor working conditions, out-of-reach interest rates, and shocking levels of inequality amid the revocation of coronavirus-era social programs and unregulated profit hoarding by corporations. In Chicago, healthcare workers were striking for better wages and conditions amid record inflation and years of overwork.
our members talk about all the time, does administration know how much the cost of a gallon of milk is, how much the cost of a dozen of eggs, you know, really is when you go to the store? It's just not adding up for them. They're having to pull double shifts, which is, you know, 12, 16-hour shifts in order to be able to pay their bills.
In the largest mass layoff event since 2020, 30,000 workers and their households are now out of a paycheck after shipping giant Yellow declared bankruptcy on the eve of a labor strike. The administration of Joe Biden refused Yellow a bailout of around $1 billion, although he spent $23 billion to save two banks earlier this year and sends over $1 billion per week to fuel the unrest in Ukraine. Yellow employees registered their disgust.
We was going to go out on the strike. We'd give them another 30 days to try to get their stuff together. And they forfeited. Of course, they tried to sue the union, which is a joke. Shame on them. They got to lay their head down on their pillow at night, what they squandered all this money away.
Corporate bankruptcies have hit their highest first half levels since 2010. And many say forcing a recession to bring down inflation is the true goal of the federal interest rate hikes, despite the damage it's already having on the average worker's household and the economy.
We understand that it's not just hospital workers, but it's a wave throughout the country in regards to a small group of people having the power and making these decisions to really not benefit the majority, but the small minority of individuals that are not having the troubles our members are paying their bills.
Widespread strikes in the United States? That's something many Americans have never seen, and certainly their mainstream media isn't spending much time talking about the labor uprisings. But the post-corona landscape is being defined by economic difficulty and social unrest. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. For the third time in 4 months, former United States President Donald Trump has been indicted. But this time, it's over his role in the controversial events in Washington on January 6, 2020. Trump pled not guilty to four counts of engaging in a criminal conspiracy to subvert the 2020 vote results and obstruction.
When you look at what's happening, this is a persecution of a political opponent. This was never supposed to happen in America. This is the persecution of the person that's leading by very, very substantial numbers in the Republican primary and leading Biden by a lot. So if you can't beat him, you persecute him or you prosecute him.
Most presidential vote polls show the race is too close to call. The ruling Democratic Party has put the United States in a historically unprecedented and potentially explosive situation. Polls show a nation evenly split on if Trump did anything illegal on January 6th, and if it is time to move on from the events that day. Trump's approval rating is up 8 points among Republicans and Republican-leaning independents since the first indictment was handed down. Many Republicans have said that the long-delayed indictments for Trump, a sweetheart plea agreement for Biden's son, and the FBI's admitted collusion with social media companies to censor reporting which could have negatively impacted Biden in 2020 is proof of political bias in the nation's judicial system. Trump's defense is likely to include that he acted on the advice of well-regarded legal counsel, which may make it difficult to show criminal intent, and that he honestly believed the vote was not legal. A new poll shows that 70% of Republicans also believe that Biden's 2020 win was illegitimate.
Multiple court cases against Trump, an increasingly likely impeachment trial in Congress for Joe Biden, ongoing corruption allegations against Joe's son Hunter Biden. The 2024 presidential campaign is shaping up to be even more divisive and full of mudslinging than in 2020. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
It has been 4 years since India removed the semi-autonomous status of the Indian administered portion of the Muslim-majority region of Jammu and Kashmir. But here, anger still rages. Hundreds of Pakistanis took to the streets across the country to mark this year's 5th August, the fourth anniversary of the New Delhi's decision to abolish the autonomy of the region by including it in the Indian Federation. In 2019, India scrapped the semi-autonomous status of the disputed region, a controversial move that prompted Islamabad to cut its diplomatic ties and halt trade with New Delhi. The protesters demanded the Indian government to end what they call illegal occupation of Kashmir, accusing it of grave human rights violations that are constantly being unearthed.
If this deliberate determination is granted to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the matter will be decided once for all. And if this matter is decided, the South Asia will be peaceful. There will be no nuclear war and there will be no conflict.
People also demanded the UN to implement a decades-old resolution that called for a referendum on whether Kashmiris wanted to merge with Pakistan or India.
We want to convey our message that we Kashmiri want our basic and fundamental right that was promised by United Nations and other organizations.
Besides rallies, conferences and seminars were also held in major cities and towns to denounce human rights violations in Jammu and Kashmir.
Whoever they are at the helm of affairs, that they should come forward and they should intervene. They should try to mitigate the human rights violations.
Kashmir, a Muslim-majority Himalayan region, is divided between India and Pakistan, and both claim it in full. The Kashmir dispute also led to several wars between the two nuclear-armed Asian rivals since they were separated back in 1947.
Pakistanis keep saying that they will continue to lend moral, diplomatic and political support to the just cause of Kashmir. They have also called on neighboring India to honor its commitments to the Kashmiri people regarding the right to self-determination. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
In the limelight.
In Britain, the government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. The government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge, The Guardian can reveal, with Prime Minister Rishi Sunak accused of betraying populations most vulnerable to global heating. The disclosure provoked fury from former ministers and representatives of vulnerable countries, who accused Prime Minister Sunak of making false promises. A leaked briefing note to ministers, given to the Foreign Office and seen by The Guardian, lays out the reasons for dropping Britain's contribution to meeting the global $100 billion a year commitment to developing countries. The leaked briefing says, "Our commitment to double our international climate finance to £11.6 billion was made back in 2019 when we were still at 0.7% of GDP spent on international aid and pre-COVID pandemic. It adds that to meet it by the deadline would be a huge challenge because of new pressures, including help for Ukraine being included in the aid budget. To meet the £11.6 billion target by 2026, government officials have calculated that it would have to spend 83% of the Foreign Office's official development assistance budget on the International Climate Fund. Civil servants said in the leaked document that this would squeeze out room for other commitments such as humanitarian commitments. It also claimed that factors such as the war in Ukraine and debt relief could make it even more difficult to meet the target. This is because the government has cut international aid spending to 0.5% of gross national income since the announcement was made, squeezing budgets across the board, and because ministers did not spend most of the money allocated to the climate fund over the past few years, leaving the majority to be spent by 2026. Britain spent £5.8 billion over the previous 5 years, up to 2021. This was doubled to spend £11.6 billion between April of 2021 and March of 2026, £3 billion of which was earmarked for protecting and restoring nature for meeting commitments made in COP15 summit last December. The projects funded included building renewable energy, helping create low-pollution transport and protecting forests in sensitive areas around the globe. Former Foreign Office Minister Zach Goldsmith, who resigned last week, citing what he termed Rishi Sunak's apathy towards the environment, said this would shred the UK's international reputation. Former Foreign Office Minister Zach Goldsmith told The Guardian, "The low levels of expenditure so far, combined with the decision to define our spending on Afghan and Ukrainian refugees here in the United Kingdom as aid, something that other countries have not done, means it is going to be virtually impossible to honour our environmental promise. The hockey stick of spending will be so steep that whoever is in government after the next election would have to savagely slash humanitarian, education, health and other funding in order to hit the £11.6 billion target. So even while it is technically possible to claim we will honour that pledge, the next government will simply not be able to do so. Small island states in particular, whose votes in the United Nations are no less valuable than ours and which are routinely needed by us, will be left feeling utterly betrayed. Given around 25 Commonwealth countries as small island states, as well as our interests in the Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean, the geopolitical repercussions will be far-reaching and our reputation as a reliable partner will simply be shredded." Last week, the British government's statutory climate advisers published a report finding that the government was missing the majority of its climate targets and had lost its position as a world leader on climate change. Countries due to receive the funding have expressed dismay at the prospect of a funding cut. Lee White, Gabon's environmental minister, said, "The climate crisis is such that every country has to contribute to the solution. Gabon is 88% covered by tropical rainforest. We have maintained deforestation below 0.1% over 5 decades and net absorb over 100 million tons of carbon dioxide annually. Few countries are doing more for the planet. Developed nations, particularly the United Kingdom, which was the origin of the Industrial Revolution, have to do the heavy lifting. But all too often, they make false promises and fail to provide true leadership or even honour their modest financial commitments." The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British government is drawing up plans to drop Britain's flagship £11.6 billion climate and nature funding pledge. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has been accused of betraying populations in countries which are most vulnerable to global warming. The decision is likely to diminish Britain's standing on the world stage as international groups accuse it of squandering its reputation. Claire Shakir, the strategic director of the International Institute for Environmental and Development, said, "A decision by this government to drop the pledge of £11.6 billion in climate finance is somewhat unsurprising, given cuts they have already made to programmes that would have used the funding. But it's no less disappointing. Not only could that funding have helped some of the most vulnerable people already facing drought, flooding and wildfires brought on by climate change, its provision was also a demonstration of Britain's leadership in the face of climate crisis. The British government seems content to squander what standing it had on the world stage to bring countries together to to face this global emergency. The briefing note suggests a departure from Britain's previous plans to be at the forefront of addressing the challenges associated with climate change and biodiversity loss. When the funding was announced, the government departments involved called climate finance the top priority for government over the next decade, and described the fund as a vital tool in the government's commitment to tackle climate change internationally. Meanwhile, the Foreign Office has declined to comment on the leak, but has pointed to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's comments made at COP27 summit regarding climate finance. A spokesperson for the Foreign Office said, "We spent over £1.4 billion on international climate finance over the course of 2021-2022 financial year, supporting developing countries to reduce poverty and respond to causes and impacts of climate change. We will publish the latest annual figures in due course." Claims that the International Climate Finance Pledge is being dropped are false. As the Prime Minister set out at the COP27 summit, the British government remains committed to spending £11.6 billion on international climate finance, and we continue to deliver on that pledge.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another racist and discriminatory decision by the Israeli extreme cabinet. Israeli Minister Smotrich has suspended funds to Arab towns and Al-Quds, citing the money will go to terrorists and criminals. He is the same minister who called for an entire Palestinian town to be wiped out. He's been described as being a racist. That is our focus for this program, how this may be a common frame of mind of extreme ministers in Prime Minister Netanyahu's cabinet and the crimes that they have committed against Palestinians. First, let me introduce our guest for this program. Khalid Barakat, spokesperson of Masar Badil Movement, joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us is Yves Zengler, author and political activist, who joins us from Montreal. Welcome to you both. Khalid Barakat, let me first start with you. What do you think about this announcement that the Israeli regime has made where millions of dollars are frozen now in funding to Palestinian councils and educational programs? And the reason that was given is based on this minister, Smotrich, that it could end up in the hands of, quote, criminals and terrorists.
Well, this is expected from the Zionist regime because, first of all, this money is not a gift from the Israeli government. Israel collects taxes from Palestinians in Al-Quds and, in fact, heavy taxes intentionally in order to drive them out of the city and to reach a 1 million settler in Jerusalem. The other thing is that these policies are just to tighten the siege on Palestinians who live in Al-Quds in order to evacuate the old city of Jerusalem and not just Al-Quds surrounding. And that will explain to you how they are accelerating their demolishing of houses and how they are creating these cantons and the isolated area in Jerusalem. Basically, even the villages that you can see Al-Aqsa Mosque from that village is now, these villages are surrounded with all kinds of checkpoints and settlements and so on and so forth. The most important thing to, I think, see in this is that what the Israeli government is doing is starving Palestinians in Al-Quds and attacking their civil institutions, particularly education and higher education. Now, remember, if Iran, for example, tomorrow say, okay, we don't want your money, we will provide that money for Palestinians in Al-Quds, Israel will refuse that. Israel will refuse any other funds because the idea is to put Palestinians under siege, particularly in Jerusalem. And they're trying to isolate Al-Quds from the rest of Palestine.
All right, Yves Zangler, when you take a look at what our guest there said, actually, he spelled it out in terms of the state funding, which is going to obviously now be cut where it serves social and educational programs at a minimum. As a result of what's going to happen possibly and potentially, this is going to leave many Palestinians in poverty. This is on top of the fact that obviously you have Palestinians that are exposed to Israeli discrimination and occupation and all the facets of an apartheid regime exercised on Palestinians. But don't you think in some sense this is going to have an opposite effect where Palestinians who, obviously many of them who are against Israel, would then potentially for Israel to risk them acting against Israel, which in turn would endanger Israel's security?
Yeah, I would say there is definitely a tension from the standpoint of administering an apartheid state. There is a tension there. And I think that you want Jewish supremacy, and we have, you know, it's longstanding. It's always been about Jewish supremacy going back to the creation of the state. But you also have a minority within the Israel proper borders. And so you discriminate, but you don't want to discriminate too far. There's also strictly economic reasons why you want a certain degree of skills among the minority population. But I think that this goes to kind of like the broader outlines of what we have in terms of the current government is you have very fanatical, messianic, colonialist Jewish supremacists running the government that are pursuing policies that even important segments of the military apparatus within Israel are uncomfortable by, because they understand that you're going to reap what you sow, that this looks bad internationally, this sort of will potentially spiral out of control. And so I think that, yeah, there is a fundamental tension there between, you know, administrating the Jewish supremacy, the apartheid policies in a smart way and doing that in a less smart way. But we will see, where this goes in terms of what the reaction is within the Palestinian citizens of Israel.
All right, well, let's take a look at some of the statements that have been made, if we can, Khaled Barakat. I'm just going to mention a few. I can't mention all of them because, obviously, for lack of time. But basically, it was not that difficult to pick them. I mean, you have Smotrich and you have Ben-Gvir, who topped the list from what I understand. Smotrich saying at one point there's no such thing as a Palestinian people. The idea of Palestinian nationhood was invented in the past century. And he went on to say some other statements regarding that. Ben-Gvir, banning Palestinian flag flying in public. Smotrich, Huwara needs to be wiped out. Israel should do it. Ben-Gvir, on execution, anyone who acts against Israel should be executed. When you have that mentality, some say, okay, these are very extreme statements, which reveals why they're acting in the way that they are. But aren't they revealing the true sentiment that Israeli have had, but they have had the guts to come and say it?
What they say, especially Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, what they say is what the Israelis say in closed rooms, including Netanyahu and across Israeli right-wing, whether secular or religious groups. Their problem with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich is that they say it publicly and not in closed rooms, and basically revealing the true intentions of the entire existence of the Zionist regime, and that is grabbing more land and less Arabs. I mean, Smotrich said that Palestinians either have to live under all our law, or they leave, or they will be killed. Their place is under the ground, he said. And basically, what these Israeli trends are growing now in the settlers, in the settlements, it has been happening since 2005, where almost 10 settler organizations were created by Ariel Sharon, then was the energy minister in Ben Netanyahu's first government. He's the one who called settlers to occupy the hills of the West Bank and to make sure that they stay there. And basically now you have paramilitary organized groups by the settlers. There are about 10 of them, 10 organizations, who actively act against Palestinians, carry all kind of crimes and aggression, burning Palestinian farms, burning Palestinian families. And they do this with impunity. Just yesterday, they released two settlers who killed a Palestinian man, and they did not spend a month in jail. And so they do it under the full protection of the Israeli army. And for Palestinians, carrying the, same policies since the 30s.
Yeah, I'm sorry to have jumped in there, because that's the something we'd like to maybe open up a little bit regarding what you just said about the one being released. Two settlers were jailed, but one was released. And Yves Engler, from what we understand, you have Itamar Ben-Gvir backing the settler, and also said the settler should be given a Medal of Honor for shooting the Palestinian. I'm mentioning this because I think from the outside and across the world, maybe people are not understanding or not up to speed with the way that these, at least these two ministers, extreme ministers, how they're going about their business with Palestinians. And that's why I need this to be highlighted. What are your thoughts about how Ben-Gvir comes out, backs the settlers, and says that he should be given a Medal of Honor for shooting the Palestinian?
It's obviously disgusting. It's a murder. It's not just a murder. It's a murder by aggressive colonialist forces. And I think 5 Palestinians have been detained for resisting these aggressive settlers killing one of their brethren. The ministers are acting like they are far right extremist activists, street activists that are launching fascist demonstrations in the streets. I mean, these are the ministers in the current Israeli government. That is what's going on. And I back to the original point, I think that there are important factions of the apartheid regime, the military types, who understand that eventually this is too much of saying what we say privately in the open, as was pointed out, and that this is eventually, this won't be sustainable in terms of, global opinion, or most specifically the opinion that really matters, which is in North America, where the U.S. and Canadian governments provide so much financial, ideological, diplomatic assistance to the apartheid regime, and that they want people running that in a more sophisticated way than running out there and talking about giving a medal to somebody who had just killed a Palestinian youth. I mean, that is there's only so much media suppression and that can go on with this. Eventually, this kind of stuff trickles out. Eventually, that support from North America will get harder and harder to sustain, hopefully.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Khaled Barkat, you mentioned the fact that, behind closed doors, maybe Israeli officials talk that way. But I'm guessing, based on some of the statements coming from some of these officials, that perhaps there's now some infighting because of the way that these extreme ministers are talking. And I'd like to refer to Benny Gantz, who's the head of the National Unity Opposition Party, as his position is. He's calling, for example, Gavir's statements, and Smotrich also, dangerous nationalistic Jewish terror. That's how he's described it. And he says that's alarming. He says, quote, the silence of our national leadership, the fact that members of the cabinet and coalition support these extremists, he refers to them as extremists, are a stain that will not be erased on our image and a danger to our security. What does that sound to you? What is he saying there?
What the Zionist regime is going through is a crisis, a comprehensive one on the identity of the regime, because we have to acknowledge that Israel have so much surplus power. And so they are arguing, how are we going to use this power? They all agree on settlements and that the West Bank and is Judea and Samaria, what they call Judea and Samaria. Basically, they mean the West Bank. And these, what they call the fanatic religious extreme, are basically saying that they are more logical and committed to the Zionist project as it was always placed, that this is the promised land and Judea, Samaria is our land, and Palestinians should not be here, and we should continue our settlement policies, and so on and so forth. So there is a consensus in the Israeli government in terms of how to deal with Palestinians, by displacing Palestinians, by besieging them, waging one war after another. I mean, Benny Gantz, who's saying this about Ben-Gvir, is the guy who launched a full-scale war against Palestinians in Gaza, placing them under siege, killing hundreds of Palestinian children. I mean, what I'm trying to say here is that there is a disagreement about how to do things. And these charged statements by Benny Gantz and others is to deter Ben-Gvir and Smotrich from saying publicly what they say, because this is harming Israel relationship. First of all, it's making it harder for Israel to normalize its relationship in the region. Also, it is jeopardizing Israel's relationship with their backers, particularly the United States and Europe. These are the countries, and Canada, that supports Israel are feeling not coupled with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, because they could cover, you know, like Ariel Sharon policies, Peretz, Tzhak Rabin, all these Israeli governments who were just war criminals, just like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, but they could defend them because they use different language. Sure. But in essence, it's the same.
Well, Yves Engler, when it comes to the issue of settlers, this extreme cabinet has made sure, if you agree, that it wants to promote Israel, the settler violence against Palestinians more than any other, in recent memory, any other Israeli cabinet. I mean, we're looking at Ben-Gvir calling for the arming of Israeli civilians. We're looking at his wife. There was a famous poster that a Google image can bring it up, where she promoted settlers to carry firearms, saying that it's okay, you need to defend yourselves, is the way she said it. And quite interestingly, you just had the Israeli army spokesperson saying settler violence against Palestinians in the West Bank was encouraging Palestinians to carry out terrorist attacks, as this spokesperson calls it, and that there has been an increase in Jewish nationalist crime and nationalist terror. Isn't this a very dangerous precedent that the promotion of settler violence against Palestinians is being set by this cabinet? Because they want, this is the risk, what many have called a civil war. I mean, is Israel going in that direction?
Well, I think that the internal Jewish criticism is not principally around the violence against Palestinians. It's principally around the you know, more self-interested in how, you know, judicial reforms may impact the rights of Jewish Israelis. I think that there's no doubt that they are encouraging settler violence. They are encouraging expansion, massive expansion in these war crimes, the, you know, growth of settlements in the West Bank. I totally agree with the previous comment about the sort of extremist in their language that leads to more difficulty for North American politicians to provide cover for Israeli war crimes. I think that there's no doubt that they're encouraging violence. And when you talk about giving a medal to someone who, you know, kills a Palestinian as part of your process of pushing more theft of Palestinian land, that's clearly what you're doing. There's these videos circulating on Twitter of different Israeli politicians, telling their like 6 or 7 year old really young kids to grow up to kill Arabs. A lot of these videos are starting to come out there of some of what these politicians have said previously. Just it's serious extremism, and it's serious extremism with incredible amount of power, right? This is a nuclear armed state. This is one of the world's most powerful militaries. This is a country with all kinds of important diplomatic backing, and Palestinians are of course with fairly limited foreign backing. There's lots of international opinion behind them, but very little sort of sources of power. And how far these fanatics in the Israeli government will go, we don't know. But we should do everything we can to weaken their ability to pursue their most violent policies.
All right. I mentioned civil war, Khaled Barakat. The reason why I mentioned that is because this terminology is now being used quite frequently. And it stems from a whole variety of dynamics that are involved in what's going on inside the occupied territories. But one of the things that was interesting is how this one particular analyst described it as saying that the genie is out of the bottle and fanatics are not going to stop until they're apocalyptic, messianic, and I think you used that word, Eves, if I'm correct. Redemption is complete, come what may. Are we looking at the possibility of the situation inside the occupied territories to escalate into that phase?
Well, what they want to do is to escalate to the maximum, because they feel that this is an opportunity for them now to grab as much land as they can and displace Palestinians. This, you know, the Zionist law of more land, less Arabs. But this is creating a problem for Israel, because the attacks and the aggression by the settlers and the army against the Palestinian people is actually generating reaction by Palestinian youth and the new generation of arming themselves as well and defending their people. And that is very legitimate. Also, the Palestinian Authority are in crisis. And what we've began to see in the West Bank is a popular authority that is being grown, and it has a popular incubator. More than 75% of Palestinians in the West Bank, according to latest polls, support armed struggle. And 85% of Palestinians disagree with totally with the PA approach, and they feel that the Palestinian Authority is a failing project. The Palestinians, not just that they're resisting as a natural and normal reaction to any people who are under colonization, but also now we began to see a very massive popular support behind the Palestinian resistance. Okay. And not just in the West Bank, this is across the board.
Steve Zengler, my final question goes to you. We're looking at what has unraveled inside Israel. In terms of the protests and the friction and crisis that they're experiencing. But when it comes to Israel's main backer, the U.S., the U.S. President Joe Biden has said that he wished that Netanyahu and his cabinet would drop the judicial reforms. Well, that has not happened. But do you really think that if U.S. wanted for Netanyahu to stop what it's doing regarding the reforms, that it could do that with one phone call? Or is it doing it with the consent of the U.S., even though on the outside we're seeing the U.S. say that it's against it? What do you think?
I think the Biden administration would prefer that the judicial reforms weren't pursued in the way they've been pursued. I think that's pretty clear to me, that they do understand that this is leading to friction within power structure within Israel that's not necessarily to the benefit of Israel or benefit of the U.S. So I don't think it's just a matter of one phone call. I do think the U.S., and for that matter, the Canadian government, but principally the U.S., has the ability to have a major impact on weakening Israel's ability to steal Palestinian land and kill Palestinians. They provide so much financial support. They have the ability to stop, you know, vetoing all these Security Council resolutions they vetoed, condemning Israel's violation of international law. They obviously pressure other governments. There are so many ways the U.S. could bring pressure to bear. But they're not doing that. And that's a matter of, you know, forcing that hand within the U.S.
Thank you so much, Yves Zengler, author and political activist from Montreal. Khaled Barka, thank you. Spokesperson of the Masar Badil Movement from Vancouver. Thanks to both of you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight.